This interview with Brigitte Kahl of Union Theological Seminary was recorded in November 2008.
I'm Brigitte Kahl, and I'm coming from Germany, so I have been in the United States for 10 years. I grew up in East Germany, and I have been teaching at Humboldt University in East Berlin. I mean, my previous life. And I was there when the Berlin Wall fell, so I have been on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And coming here is, of course, a very, very fascinating experience for me. I'm teaching New Testament, and the students we have are very, very interesting people. They come from all ranges of life, and they come from different experiences in life, and some of them are just coming from college. Others have already a career behind them. They wanted to quit. Some are business people, lawyers, and they bring all this incredible experience of life. And what I try to do, and what basically we all try to do at Union, is really creating a learning community where there are the teachers, the professors, but there are also the students who bring all this in.
And what languages do you have to learn in New Testament scholarship?
In New Testament, you basically have, of course, to learn Greek, but I bring Hebrew and Latin, and I think none of these two languages I could miss. Of course, it's also very, very good if you have other ancient languages like Coptic, for instance, because there are a lot of other sources out that are kind of parallel to the New Testament, and they are very important for us to understand what our, in quotation marks, our texts speak about. But I think Greek is necessary. It's absolute prerequisite. And Hebrew, I would say, too, because that is the language of the First Testament, and the First Testament and Second Testament texts cannot really be separated. And Latin is important because the Roman contexts also matter a lot, I believe.
So tell me about some of the things you do on a day-to-day basis. What is a good day's work for you?
Well, basically what I understand myself to be doing is really to listen to texts. Very, very basic. To listen what these texts are saying and what it means and why it matters. I think these are my big three questions. And then, of course, in order to find that out, you do a lot of things. And it is amazing how many different things you really do as a biblical scholar. You start as a translator. Even earlier, you look at strange letters in Greek or in Hebrew that don't look like our letters. And you kind of look at punctuation and at accents. And then you see how these letters merge into words. And then you look how the words function. You look at cases and declension, and then there is the grammar of a text, and how does a text make sense. Then, of course, you have to go outside the text. You have to look at other texts that talk to our texts. You have to look at sources. And you have not only to look at written sources, I believe, but also at visual sources. I mean, so you have architecture that you know was around at Paul's time, for instance, or at Jesus' time. And then you ask yourself, what does this architecture say about how these people saw the world? And you have images, and you have passageways, and you have spaces that are structured in a certain way. And all that gives you a more comprehensive image of the world that is around the words, and that helps us read the words. You have to know about how the texts have been interpreted throughout history, what they meant to different people, and also how they have harmed people, not only how they have healed, but also how they have hurt, and what we have done with these texts, and how there is sometimes, or I mean, and that is a terrible chapter, but that our texts are sometimes really drenched in blood. So what they are carrying with them, the historical baggage, colonialism, and kind of forced Christianization and all these things. So, and then you eventually end up in present time. And then the question, what are people doing with these texts today, and how should we responsibly read them today? What is the word of God today, and what does it mean if we look at our time and our struggles and our concerns and crises?
What's your research interest right now?
Well, I'm obsessed with Paul right now. So Paul is a big, it's one of the two parts of the New Testament. So you have Jesus and the Gospels on the one hand, and then you have Paul basically on the other hand. And I am for some reason have been drawn into Paul, and I can't really get out of it again. So because Paul, of course, is this, if we talk about how texts have harmed people, then Paul, of course, is a first candidate in that, because much of Christian anti-Judaism is attached to Paul, for instance. So the horrible story of Christian supersessionism and exclusivism with regard to Judaism is very much linked to Paul. But then also the whole relationship of Paul to women is a big topic. And whenever I teach a class on Paul and I ask the students, what do you think about him? Then it's a very sad story how Paul has been preached in churches in order to keep women really down, to deprive them of their voice and to tell them that they have to accept an order of things where they are at the bottom of society. And that is really the will of God as interpreted by Paul. So these are the two big problems. But of course, also he has been interpreted or has been quoted as a very homophobic voice in the New Testament. And then in general, as the big conservative voice also, Romans 13 is the proclamation of Christians need to accept the order of any given order, and they have to submit to authorities, even if the authorities do something very bad. I mean, like this text in Nazi Germany has been used to tell people, well, you cannot do anything against Hitler, for instance, because Hitler is an authority that has been installed by God. So this is a very heavy baggage Paul carries. And my big question is this really the biblical Paul? Or is this a Paul that has been made up by Christian tradition? A Paul that Christianity, as it slowly moved up into the power structures of the Roman Empire, a Paul that they needed in order to legitimize established power. So that is my big question. And I'm reading the letter to the Galatians primarily.
You mentioned women, and I'm curious, what is it like? Is there any difference being a woman Bible scholar?
I believe that I'm the first woman professor in New Testament at Union Theological Seminary. I think there was never a female predecessor to that position. And when I took up theology at the beginning of the 70s, I remember that my mother told me, why do you do that? I mean, if you cannot, there was not even ordination, women's ordination at that time. And she said, well, this is a dead-end study for a woman. How can you do such a thing? And that changed then in the 70s and in the 80s. But we must remember that this is very recent, that due to the changes that happened in the 60s, I mean, that theology has acknowledged that something is wrong with keeping women silent in the churches and then also in academia. And that is, of course, a quote from Paul, from the first letter to the Corinthians, women be silent in the church. So that is how Paul has functioned in the history of interpretation. And my question is there a different Paul? What if Paul said something else than what we made him say?
Are you finding that?
Yes.
Yet? You are.
Uh-huh. Yes. I'm. How I approach this, and this is part of my method. I think what we get out of a text is depends in front of which background we read it. And what we have never done is reading Paul before the background of the Roman Empire. We knew that there is Judaism as a big player in the world of Paul, and that is true, of course. But we never acknowledged that the Roman Empire was the major force that determined everything at Paul's time. And that switch changes a lot how we read his texts. I mean, you see, the conversation partner we think Paul is in dialogue with, that and if we then consider what was the other voice in the room that is not recorded in a letter, because in a letter we have only Paul's voice, of course, but in the real life situation where these letters were functioning, there were other voices in the room, only we don't have them, so we must imagine them. And this is my, what I call it, critical reimagination. I try to reimagine using images a lot and visual environments in order to understand what does this text say in this specific environment. And if we just look at the conservative Paul, I see that whatever Paul did was very much an alternative vision of human life than the vision the Romans had. So I can see how the images clash. The image Paul builds up of how a community should function and live, and the vision the Romans would portray everywhere with their enormous power and the power of their images. So I can see how the images talk to each other and contradict each other. And I see that Paul is not this kind of obedient Roman citizen that honors Caesar, but rather that he disputes the way the Romans ordered the world in a very, very substantial way.
So how would a Roman temple, for example, have been influenced during Paul's time?
I mean, I'm not so much interested in asking, what is the temple? I mean, of course, in the temple you have the big image of the god and the power. It's a construct of power very much. But I'm looking at it from below very much, and I'm looking at who are the people who carry it and who are the people also who visit it. What happens if you enter in such a space? What happens to you? And then, of course, temples.
You feel dwarfed by it.
Yes, you feel dwarfed. And you feel, you want to, you have a desire to get closer to the center. But at the same time, the center makes you small. I mean, and people are arranged, those who are close, and then there are the priests, and then there are the sacrifices where all can participate, but of course all are then integrated into this power construct. So that is, and of course these temples were all around, and we know that, for instance, Paul was fiercely opposing to become part of these constructs. So this is the idols for him. And so the question is, what is he attacking when he says no idols? And I think it's not what we think, it's other gods and other religions, but I think it's this power construct that is always kind of embodied in this architecture and in also in these gods who embody power. So and I think that the biblical God is always a God who has this underside perspective, who looks at the people who are carrying it and who are burdened with holding it up. So I think when Paul attacks idols, he attacks imperial religion, not other religions in general, imperial religions. Religion that is very powerful at his time, because at his time Caesar has really declared that he is the sole ruler of your universe and the god. So it's no longer the Greek gods, the Olympic gods. The Romans have kind of topped it all, and they have imposed their own super religion on every indigenous religion, including Greek religion. So
at this time, were most Christian communities being evolving in a home?
Yes.
Environment and not a temple.
It's so interesting. They didn't have temples. They didn't build temples. They didn't build churches. They came together in houses, in a very kind of modest environment, maybe sometimes even kitchens. I think that much, yes. Much talk went on in kitchens. But they had their meals in these kind of house domestic spaces. And I think they were very much alien from the temple construct, which was the big public religion of that time.
Are there any habits of mind or core values that help you be a Bible scholar?
Yes, I mean, you have to be, of many things. I mean, you have to be really very obsessed about detail. I mean, you have to really to look at the letters, and you have to search the words, and you sometimes a word will keep you up at night because you didn't find the right dictionary that gives you the meaning you are looking for, and so this is the one thing. But the other thing is that you are detail obsessed. That's true, but on the other hand, I think what is important is also that the big questions are there always. So a biblical scholar has to combine the small detail, accuracy and precision and the passion for being precise. And on the other hand, the very big questions of what happens to humanity now and where are we? And what happens to the poor? And what happens to the people who can't get in, who are at the bottom, who are out, and we want to push them out? And what does this text say about them? And we have also to, as biblical scholars, we are very academic in one way, and we need to study a lot. And none of that we can just throw away. I mean, I know that languages, ancient languages, are torturous, but still we cannot afford not to do that. But on the other hand, we have also to learn to listen to the ordinary people, to do Bible study, for instance, with them. And I'm at Union, we have the Poverty Initiative, and we do Bible reading with the poor. And I couldn't miss that part either, because they teach me something I could never think about. So they have a perceptiveness about the text that complements what I am doing. So I can teach them something, but sometimes I think they teach me more. You need to have this patience and also, in a way, humility to read the text in contexts where people are not particularly impressed by what you are as a biblical scholar and as an academic person. And you just need to be ready to listen. And so the third thing I think that is important is that you need to be curious about what texts mean. And you should never be satisfied with a given and an established interpretation.
Which leads me to my last question, is what are the rewards for you?
It's the most unboring job I can think of.